This is Michelle Schabowski interviewing Jude Payton on June 20th, 2017. I am in the PA History Society office, and where are you today, sir?
I'm in near Sacramento, California, in Yuba City, California.
So could you please say your name and spell it, and also say any credentials that you have, and this is for future transcribers.
Okay, my name is Jude Patton. It's spelled J-U-D-E. Last name is P-A-T-T-O-N. I am a physician assistant. I work in psychiatry. I also have two mental health mid-level practitioner licenses. One is a marriage and family therapist, and the other is a certified mental health counselor.
Would you tell us a bit about your background, like your hometown, what college did you attend, things like that?
Okay, I grew up in Illinois, moved to California in 1965, had not at that time had any college level training, and was working in animal care as a veterinary medical technician. Moved in Venice, California, and then moved to Orange County, California. In 1973, I began college classes. I was then 33 years old. I just went straight through because I had always been self-educated and took, oh my gosh, I did 37 units in one semester because I could, and by attending three different colleges and working five different part-time jobs in animal care. Mm-hmm. So I've always been pretty self-motivated. I eventually got a master's degree in psychology, and the same year read an ad for USC School of Medicine's physician assistant program, which at that time was just opening its doors to non-ex-medics. Until then, it was only ex-medics from the military that they would accept into their program. And I qualified to get in because I had already started training, hopefully, to become a veterinarian. So I had all the science courses they needed, but they accepted me because I had a master's degree in psychology and was already licensed as a marriage and family therapist. So my focus was very different. We had 32 students in our program who started, and my focus was to stay. I knew I would stay in psychiatry if I could, and the rest were more, I call it, mechanically oriented. They wanted to do general medicine. Of course, everybody was trained as a family practice person. I started my first job as a PA, actually, in none of the above. I started in toxicology.
Oh, okay.
which was very interesting. And I also did just a variety of experiences in several different settings, family practice, orthopedics, neurology, and so on. And at that time, a lot of PAs and nurse practitioners were also employed in clinics that manage work injuries and legal medicine. And I got very involved in developing my own business in legal medicine. My wife was a medical transcriber, and so in addition to me working in offices and both of us reviewing tons of medical records, in our own business, we also wrote, we became what are called ghostwriters. We would get all the information from the doctors who did the evaluations, and then we would write up the legal arguments about whether or not, depending on whether we were working for an insurance company or for patient-oriented practices, we'd do a legal argument with the information that we had. It basically was saving doctors a lot of money and a lot of intensity about so much paperwork. And we did quite well until they changed the laws in California for the evaluations and the amount of money that they paid. So I went back to just working for other doctors. And since that time, it's all been psychiatry. So I've been a PA for, 35 years. And all during that time, I also entertained a part-time private practice as a therapist outside of that. My last number of years, the last 15 years or so, I worked primarily in, well, always in psychiatry, usually for community clinics, and with populations that are underserved. And that's my job right now. I work in a community clinic, and I see homeless, chronically mentally ill adults. The other thing is, yes, the most important thing to me in my humanity and my personal stuff and why I'm doing what I'm doing is to add the fact that I have, I am transgender myself. Mm-hmm. I transitioned in my, well, surgery was in 72 and 73 at Stanford University. And right away, my surgeon at the time responded to my request to become involved in any way I could to helping other people go through what I had just been through. I was also lucky to live in Southern California, and I had already been very, very interested in the whole field of human sexuality, so I got myself certified as a sex therapist and sex educator by ASECT, and was also a member of the Society for the Scientific Study of Sexuality and several other national and international organizations about the general field of sexuality. But my focus has always been with LGBT people, and of course the T is primary in that. I've always done my private practice as a therapist, so that's the main issue that I work with. And it's been an interesting road because I had chosen from the beginning never to be in a closet, ever in a closet. So I live my life as if I'm out all the time. The problem with that is, as I've grown much older and as my past, you know, so many years of this now, 45 years of being in my current role as quote-unquote male, people just don't ask. They don't know. I'm just some guy down the street. And I am some old guy down the street. But they're curious why I have the interests that I do. And so I don't necessarily disclose to every client, you know, that walks in the door, just as I don't expect them to do that with me. If they do ask or they do have what I see as a positive benefit from knowing that about, I'll volunteer the information. Most of my clients just don't know. Mm-hmm. It's not part of what their life is about, and they're there to be served, not me.
Right. What influenced you to join the medical field to begin with? Like you said, you started thinking you wanted to be a veterinarian?
Yes, I had always been very, very fond of animals, always. Mm-hmm. Still am. As time, it was just unfortunate situations. When I was younger, my dad died when I was 20. He had been ill for 10 years. My mother was very dependent on him. She had a depression when he died, and I stayed home and took care of her and my grandmother rather than to do anything else until I moved to California. And that was a big influence of my early years. But my desire to be a veterinarian was still there. I worked in veterinary hospitals as an assistant with surgery and medication and everything else there is to do. So I thought, okay, maybe I can still do this. But when I went to UC Irvine for my undergraduate degree, my faculty advisor told me, you know, you're going to be 38 when you graduate. And I'm here to tell you that I worked at UC Davis in Berkeley in administration, and I don't care if your parent was an alumna, mm-hmm. and they had millions of dollars, you're not going to get in at this age. So I switched my major to psychology and thought, okay, and never even really thought I would do anything more than that I would stay just as a psychologist or neuropsychiatry or neuropsychology. And then when I saw that opening at USC, I thought, well, maybe I can do this. You know,
So had you met a PA prior to that? Did you kind of know what they were before that? Or did you just
I knew what they were. Yeah, I knew what they were, but I never, you know, anticipated that I had gone through enough exploration at that point that the programs at the time, this was 1980 that I went into the program. To my knowledge, the ones I had explored, there were far fewer programs than there are now. All of them were limited to ex-medics. They didn't have another avenue to come in, and I had never been in the military. I'd never been a nurse. I'd never been anything in human medicine, but I did have the degree in psychology. Mm-hmm. So once I saw that, another explanation. You know, I thought, oh, well, I'll try. This time my age served me. It's interesting. This time USC was right down the middle about meeting all the quotas for equality. And they had one opening for a quote-unquote old man and one for an old woman. And they had 16 people of color and 16 people who were white. They had, honest to God, they really were meeting everything. And I was a quote old man. I was 40 when they accepted me.
I was going to say, can you talk a bit about your activism in the transgender community? But that started a bit before you became a PA, didn't it?
It did. And that was, again, mostly because of what I was doing in the psychology courses and already doing volunteer work for others. But most of them, trans issues, it was just living the thing and finding out. Remember, no computers.
Yeah.
Remember, no laws to protect anybody very much. And so a lot of this was people repeating and depending on their ability to find information. During the first several years that I did the work, or maybe the first 10 to 15 years, the majority of people came to me not so much for the usual things they do today, but simply because they couldn't find information themselves.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm one of these people that pretty much doesn't give up.
Mm-hmm.
And fairly decent. I've published a newsletter and this and that and something else. We can go into that later.
Yes. Right, so the newsletter was the Renaissance?
Yes.
Okay.
It's called the Renaissance Newsletter. And I started publishing that about 1976 through 1981.
Mm-hmm.
But I already, in 1973, a friend of mine who had been asked by a college professor from Cal State Fullerton to come and speak in his class about the experience of being trans, and he didn't want to do it, so he asked me if he could give my name to the instructor. His name was Howard Fradkin. And I called Howard, and he was excited to have me do it. And I said, but I'm kind of, not a speaker, really, and I'm kind of anxious about speaking at all. And he reassured me that he would already have his students well-prepared, and it would just be a question-and-answer session. Well, that led to, by 3 years later, I was speaking to over 200 classes every year. And you have to tie this in with the new interest or the boom in the interest in teaching about human sexuality at a college level, because there was one community college nearby that had 22 different classes every semester in Human Sexuality 101. So I became, and he told several of his friends, and then the ensuing years, I probably went to every I'm not exaggerating, to every community college, four-year college, graduate study program, medical school, between just north of Los Angeles down to San Diego and inland. Anybody who asked me, I would find time to go. I could do this because I was working. I created my own schedule for working, and had two or three part-time jobs and my private practice that I could, set my own hours and stuff, and then set my hours otherwise to go speak. And in that process, I was very, very, very lucky. I had already met some of these people. I met the, what I call the movers and the shakers of the LGBT communities even way back when there was hardly anybody, at least in the Southern California area. I also was exposed to and had great mentoring and good friendships with people in the field of human sexuality who were then the presidents of national organizations who were writing prolifically, like Vern and Bonnie Bordeaux wrote a lot about the history of sexuality and helped form a master's program in human sexuality at Cal State Northridge. I also met Bill Hartman and Marilyn Fithian, who were known as the West Coast Masters and Johnson in human sexuality, and was part of their program in the Center for Sex Research in Long Beach, and just people who would draw me in to participate with them and mentor me and give me opportunities that, frankly, other people didn't have. I was so grateful that they were that caring about me to include me. And then I did, as a result, probably from some of the other stuff. Remember, I mean, even now, I think there are more, certainly more now, but back then, until Steve Dane came out, or was outed with his situation, there was no FTM person out. Everybody was stealth. Everybody was in a closet about having ever been female. And so I was the only one. I did all kinds of, I've been going through some of the boxes of material I had. There's a Newsweek article in November of 1976 there, at the same time. They drew that information from an L.A. Times article that was on the front page. I was doing a lot of media stuff, talk shows, and so on. And there wasn't, until Steve came out, there was not another FTM person out there doing any of that. There were several male-to-female trans people. And the only book I knew about, I think, was written in 1977, the first book, an FTM wrote in the United States, at least, was called Emergence. And so I was in touch with him, the author, and another person in Toronto, Canada, Rupert Raj. And Rupert and I still talk to each other from time to time. I just saw him a year ago at a conference. And the other person, we think, has probably passed away, but we're not sure. And the first conference, you know, I need to emphasize this because a lot of people still don't have this experience. I was very, very lucky. Very, very lucky. And I'm so open-minded and reach out and get reached out to by so many different, I want to call it subgroups or other definitions of trans or in the spectrum. So I've always been very close, even before in the lesbian and gay community, there's a lot, and still is, a lot of separatism between the men and the women. Mm-hmm. So a bar may be designated, and it's all of, you see there is gay guys, and only rarely a lesbian friend of one of theirs, and vice versa, be a lesbian bar, and hardly see any men in there unless they were invited friends. Not a lot of collaboration, either socially or other, maybe more politically than anything else, but certainly not socially. And then I also met Virginia Prince very early on in some of the work I was doing, and got involved in all these different straight cross-dressers clubs and the whole spectrum of cross-dressers clubs and the whole spectrum of transgender things. So I was already going to the cross-dressers conferences. I was the only person there, like myself. But I met a lot of friends and had a lot of clients who were, and still do. And then the whole spectrum of sexuality and sexual expression. And it's been I would say, there aren't many people who've had those kinds of experiences. The whole spectrum of experiences and people that are not only friendly, but personal friends and people that I've met and gone to different kinds of conferences with. And there weren't until the late 80s, the kinds of trans conferences that you see now, the huge ones, right, or even some of the small ones. So I've had that.
You wrote the Renaissance newsletter.
Mm-hmm.
You started lecturing at colleges and to medical professionals.
Right.
And then you started a group called Renaissance Gender Identity Services.
That's true. And it wasn't, I don't know how to put it. For me, it wasn't necessarily a support group, but it was, and it was, didn't have general meetings or anything like it. It didn't have an agenda. What it was nobody, people didn't have a place to go, and they needed to have a place to go and get more information and meet other people who were trans. So I started holding little gatherings at my house, which grew into several smaller meetings each year. Most of those were FTM guys with a few MTF people thrown in. Then it got to be more than equal, and you know, the descriptions. And then once a year, I'd hold a large party that would be about 150 people, and that included professionals who would come.
Okay.
And have an opportunity to be in a different setting than a clinical setting for people they were trying to serve.
Okay, so a little bit more relaxed atmosphere then.
Right, and people, it was all on, you know, an invitation, but with an open invitation to invite others that you knew who might want to come, people I didn't know, that sort of thing.
Right.
And then I also, about the same time, met a psychologist in Orange County, Dr. William Hurd, who had just started to run a group for people who were planning to go on to surgery, you know, to get all their doing necessary letters and needs met in that way, and have some counseling beyond just information if they wanted that. And I worked with him for almost 13 years, and that was called Orange County Gender Dysphoria Program. About the same time, you know, everything just sort of, when I started the newsletter, Renaissance, which ultimately included the group, the reason I started the newsletter was because there wasn't a newsletter that I knew of, other than a little bit later finding out there were some few published by some cross-dressers and other groups, okay? And the other reason was Erickson Educational Foundation had a newsletter that they published, which was like 4 pages. It came out twice a year. It only had limited information. I thought, well, maybe, not that I could do something better, but that I could do something that was more inclusive. So I, that's the instance of that. And then about this, then Erickson stopped publishing its newsletter. The Erickson Educational Foundation was given over to Paul Walker in Texas. Paul moved to San Francisco. Eventually, he gave up the newsletter, or not the newsletter. He gave up the Erickson's work to me and Joanna Clark, who had joined me in Renaissance. And then we gave it up a few years later to Dallas Denny, who had already been publishing her own newsletter. So there was a lot of stuff that went on that was personal and more to try to keep something going that had been there for a long time, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And then probably, I would say, with the advent of the Internet, most of those things collapsed. And many, many therapists who had been, until that time, writing gleefully on the funds they earned from seeing trans people went bankrupt because...
it's all online now.
Yeah, sources.
Okay, so after you did all of that,
You
went into PA school, right?
Right. Well, we were doing it. Yeah, actually, we did all of that stuff in the mid-70s through the 80s, and I didn't start PA school until 1980.
Can you tell me, so you were on, what was it called, the Harry Benjamin International Gender Dysphoria Association?
Right.
Can you tell me a bit about that?
So I was already a member because my surgeon, that was one of the things, he was the president of the organization at one time. I asked him if I could come to one of their meetings. This was before it was ever H Bigda. I asked him, I went to a meeting in 1973. But it became H Bigda in 1979 and published the first standards of care. And the story goes, we're in where we are, and someone, I'm pretty sure it was him, suggested that thought it would be a good idea to have a consumer advocate, okay, on their board of directors. So he suggested me.
So what does consumer advocate mean? Like someone
that means like a liaison between the community,
okay.
Because the community has the community, by community I mean the community mostly of heterosexual cross-dressers and some trans people who were male to female were far more outspoken than any FT. Remember, there weren't FTM people being. And they were in-your-face types, angry that they weren't being included and their needs weren't being heard and their, you know, and rightfully so. And they were actually afraid of them. And many of the people doing this work at the time who were surgeons, anybody, thought we were crazy and that they were simply helping crazy people be more comfortable, okay? So when we put it to a vote, it was a Sunday morning. Most of the people had gone home. There were probably 31 or two people left there that morning when they were discussing this, and Dr. Raub put it up for a vote for me to be that consumer. And it tied at 14-14, and he cast the winning vote, and so I became the consumer advocate for 6 years of that. I did not have voting rights. I was a member, but I didn't have voting rights as a consumer advocate. I had input rights, and they did do a little bit of listening. But remember, at that time, I didn't even have my degree. That was 1979. I hadn't even started medical school. So, and then I stayed with the organization, became a member. At times, I would do presentations and this and that, you know, be invited to do that or be on a committee to decide which papers were going to be read. Kept in contact with other people, and then in 1999 to 2001, they selected me as a board member again, but this time as a full-fledged board member. And it wasn't until some years later that any open trans person became a president, or and then that person was Stephen Whittle from England, and then more recently James Green. There are still people, by the way, who are on the board and in the membership who believe we're all crazy and don't want any of us there. But far fewer.
Oh, good. Okay, at least there's that.
The real fear in those days, and I have a letter from Paul Walker, who has been very involved and on the board, to prove it. I kept some of these letters. I thank God I did. And he was talking about they were trying to regulate the membership, and their fear was there would be more community members as members of the organization than regular people. Yeah, whatever that is.
Right. Okay, so while you were on the HBI, what do you call it? HBIGDA?
I call it HBIGDA, HBIGDA.
Right, the HBIGDA board. What kind of issues were brought up?
For me, in looking back, the overall concern was doctors not getting sued and having regulations that protected the clients. Mm-hmm. And over the years, clients have always felt the regulations restricted them, and still do. You know, arriving at a decision with an organization made up of people from all over the world with different types of medical care situations and insurance, non-insurance, social medicine, you know, all that. And the concerns then more recently, about 20 years ago, about children and adolescents, and I'll sidetrack one, at least once more. My current concern is in all the 38 years, they've had regulations, they've never addressed the issue of elders. So now they're hopefully going to start to do that too. But at any rate, it was mostly around the issues of how do you make these decisions, how does each region or each group, how do you come up to a consensus with a world organization that would include everyone's needs, you know? How do you regulate or try to regulate? So mostly it was about protection, and frankly, a bit of a part of it was about protecting the doctors from lawsuits and stuff, protecting the clients from doctors who are just butchers and sitting online and selling their goods and their wares, and then trying to put in, you know, evidence-based medicine as that came along. That became the new rage, and having some, I think they made some mistakes with their language. They should have called it from the beginning guidelines of care and not standards of care.
Right. You were involved with that, coming up with that, or...
Like, no, they had already done most of that work by the time I joined it, though my name is on that initial one because I was there. Actually, the work was done, the majority of it had been already done and agreed on. And, frankly, in the early years, this is just my take on it. In the early years, it was still grounded with... All the people we serve are crazy, and we're trying to do what's right for them. I mean, that's my boiled it down to that, okay?
Right.
And there were really, truly, truly, you know, meaningful kinds of things they were trying to do. Then came a time when the governing part, the board, was mostly made up of psychoanalysts from Cleveland and places like that, who were even more convinced that we... needed to be fixed if they could.
Right.
And the last resort would be surgical intervention, hormonal interventions. During that time, everybody who was involved in rewriting the standards of care dragged their feet. It took them 12, I don't know how many years, I could look at the different versions, but they were still in a place until Sheila Kirk and I were elected to the board. And James Green, whom a lot of people in this country despise because of his early work with quote-unquote sissy boys, he's now back in England and had been for several years, and he was the president. Mm-hmm. And he was instrumental, literally, in asking Sheila and making sure that Sheila and I got on the board. And I can remember a conversation and how easily things changed. So we're sitting there. James Green was there as part of the committee. He wasn't a board member at that time or president, but he was there because he was part of the committee working on changing the standards of care.
Right.
And there was this group of people sitting around a big table. And I popped up, and James agreed. I said, you know, it seems silly to me that because of their standards of care with that standard, you know, first you do this, first then you do this, then you do that, and then you do this, in a sort of a triad kind of treatment. And they were also talking about the, you know, 6 months. They'd gotten it down to only 6 months of therapy before you can get a chest reconstruction.
Right.
And I said, you know, I think that's really silly. I said, any cis woman, although we didn't use those terms then, but any cis woman can get her breasts shaped any way she wants. She can get them enlarged, she can get them reduced, she can have them reshaped, she can do anything, and she doesn't have to undergo a psychological evaluation. I said, what's this? We have to go through all this stuff and wait 6 months just to get your, you know, chest reconstructed to a way that looks natural and normal for you?
Mm-hmm.
And I said, well, that makes sense. Let's change that. I'm serious.
Yeah.
Sitting at a table with these people, and after 12 or 14 years of all this arguing about that crap, mm-hmm. well, that makes sense. That changes.
Right.
And then we said, well, let's change some other things, too. And more got done mm-hmm. in a half an hour than had gotten done in all those years.
So what other things changed, if you don't mind my asking? So,
well, at the same meeting, they started talking about the triad of care. There are some
right.
people who will never want, no matter how large their breasts are or aren't, will never want any kind of surgery,
right.
or may want bottom surgery, but not top surgery. There are people who want bottom surgery who can't get it, and there are many, many people who will never be able to afford all that, ever,
right.
no matter what insurance changes or wanting. Why do they have to have hormones if, and this is not about hormones making them ill, if they feel comfortable in their own body with whatever they have, that should be the determining factor. And so people began to see more of that and hear more of that. And before, you weren't considered, quote, truly transsexual unless you wanted to get rid of every body part that would ever remind you of what your original sex was. So they began to consider all those things at once. They said, well, yeah. And then I can't say it was at the same time, I think it's almost at the same time, they already had said, okay, they got to a place where with the breast surgery, once you had your, they reduced it from 6 months of therapy, or however they wouldn't ever, you didn't have to, how many times that meant in 6 months or anything, it got down to, okay, an evaluation. And once you pass the initial evaluation, then you could get your chest done right away. You know, with female to male, they recommended that male to female people at least give a couple of years. This was, willingly give a couple of years to see what hormones would do without, might not need breast enlargement of the patient. So then they decided, okay, then there should be no order to this. There are people who will want to wait. There are people who will want to get their chest done long before they ever start hormones, because starting hormones is growing obvious facial hair or starting to bald and still having difficulty strapping down large breasts.
Right.
It's a hard thing to do. And this sort of real-life test. So eventually, within a very short period of time, the standards of care changed very drastically to say what they do now. And then they started focusing on the kids, what you could do for kids or not do, or when you can do it, and they're still arguing the when. And I think, they're just now coming to terms with the fact that they need to be, worried more about outcomes. That got in there, thanks to Gulen and their group mm-hmm. in Europe. What happens to people who've been on hormones X amount of time?
Right.
Or year, and getting some more outcome studies. So now they're working again on more outcome studies, to my knowledge, to opening up to even more or even fewer restrictions on signing the client signs a piece of paper. They've been told and they understand what they're going through. And
yes, it's like a waiver or something.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Right.
I can't. There's another term for it, but I can't think of it now that you asked me.
Yeah.
But yes, that they accept. Mm-hmm. that they're part of this test, and
right. It's like you do to have a tonsillectomy.
Right, and that was like in the 90s that this was. Well, throughout like the second.
Yeah, this started to happen. That change took place, I think, in 1999, 2001.
Okay.
Around there. Mm-hmm. I don't have the exact years either. I have copies of all of the different changes and mm-hmm. stuff the standards of care. But it is time to change them. It is time to be more inclusive.
Mm-hmm.
I and another person spoke up at the meeting in Los Angeles, both of us, Kelly Winters. She's a pretty outspoken FTM person.
Mm-hmm.
She stood up. I stood up to have microphones on either side of the room, and I I've got to get my words in about this elder stuff. And by the time I got to the microphone, there were two people in front of me on my side, and she got up and said it first. But then I took my time to say it again about it. But there's I don't know. I'm so bad. For me, there will never be that interest. It's always about the youth. What happens to children, they're our future. These old folks are on their way out the door. Who cares? Until you get to be one yourself and start having some of the health issues going on. For instance, they had to put me on a Plavix, and I was on all that, an NSAID for my pain.
Yeah.
So they had to take me off. Mm-hmm. Okay. They had to talk about how much testosterone I should be using. And on and on and on,
right.
Which was never a consideration before that.
I've noticed online that you're very active in the aging population of the transgender community, making people aware of that. So is that a main issue?
That is a main issue for me now, obviously for self-serving purposes,
right.
But also because it has been forgotten, because it's been left out in because other things have seemed so much more important in years gone by, just establishing care to begin with and establishing some sort of just getting your foot in the door. The worries for me about the aging, for instance, just to use my recent hospital experience, I thought, the same thing as other people.
Mm-hmm.
What happens when I actually refused to go to the hospital when my symptoms started and they were starting to get worse, and my partner took me in. Thank God she was there with me, and we both chose to say Jude's a trans person, and we expect him to be treated with the dignity and respect that anybody needs. We don't want any problems with this. And they said no problem, and there wasn't. I mean, who said what behind my back or to her? Neither of us heard, but the upfront care was fine.
Okay. So what has been the most meaningful part of your career as a physician assistant?
Well, I think working with a variety of people, mostly the most meaningful piece to me is underserved people and trying to undo some of the, I shouldn't say this, but some of the wrongs that have been done by other therapists and other doctors who didn't serve well. And that can be even with, I'll give you one for instance. I had a client who had been community mental health system since he was 16, had his first schizophrenic break, 16. Been on medications all that time, was very paranoid, would not go out of his house except to see me once a month, and to go to the bank and store once a month to get a positive check and get groceries. I was asking him something about the voices he heard and so on, and he said, Jude, you know, you're the first person in all these years that I've seen doctors who has ever talked to me as if I'm a real person.
Aww.
I thought, how sad that is. That so many people under the guise of help receive what may look like to them substandard medicine, but they don't know how to, you know, take the initiative or have the personal strength to change doctors or whatever's going on. So for me, it's serving the underserved and the old Hippocratic oath about first do no harm.
And thank you very much. This has been a great interview.
Oh, you're welcome.